Hello, and welcome to the CJPME Debrief Podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Together, we discuss developments and issues in Canada's relationship with Palestine and the broader Middle East. Through our conversations, we make sense of events in the region and how people in Canada can respond. In this episode, we'll be joined by Anthony Lowenstein to discuss his latest book, The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. We'll discuss how Israel's arms industry uses the occupied Palestinian territories as a testing ground for weaponry and surveillance technology that it then exports around the world. We'll also discuss the censorship of Palestinians and their allies by social media companies, and the growing impact of direct action campaigns against Israeli weapons manufacturers like Elbit Systems. My name is Michael Buechert, Vice President of CJPME, and the podcast host for today. With me is Reem Majid, a policy analyst here at CJPME, and our podcast co-host for today. Good afternoon, Reem.
Good afternoon, Michael. I'm very excited to be here.
And we're both very excited to be joined by Anthony Lowenstein. He is an Australian/German journalist, best-selling author, and filmmaker. He's a co-founder of the online publication Declassified Australia. Anthony has written for the New York Times, The Guardian, The Washington Post, Al Jazeera English, and many others. And as mentioned, his latest book, which we'll be discussing today, is called The Palestine Laboratory, which was, I think, just published by Verso very recently. So, Anthony, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we dive too much into the substance of your book, we do want to get a sense of who you are and how you came to this work. You write in your introduction that you grew up in a liberal Zionist home where support for Israel wasn't a required religion, but certainly expected. Can you talk us through your evolution to becoming, I don't know if you'd call yourself an anti-Zionist, but how you got involved in the Palestine Solidarity Movement?
Definitely. I grew up in Melbourne, Australia, and in, as I said, and as I wrote, yeah, it was a liberal Zionist home. And I guess for many people, at least who are Jewish, who are listening to this, will probably understand this. I think there is a shift going on in the Jewish community, which we can talk about. But I think in general, it's probably still pretty uncontroversial to say that a lot of people growing up in Western countries in the Jewish community are still fairly Zionist. Obviously, what that means is a wide variety of things. But I did not go to a Jewish school, but I went to synagogue. I was liberal. My family was secular. You know, we weren't a religious home. Most of my family were killed in the Holocaust. It was a sadly fairly typical Jewish story. In fact, a lot of my family came to Canada around 1939 and afterwards, and some of them are still there in Toronto. And I think Israel was just something you believed in. Israel was just something that you supported. Israel was just part of who you were. I'd never been to Israel. Most of my family had not been. A few had, but most had not. And there was what really struck me, and I remember this very clearly from my teenage years, and I'm in my late 40s now, so it was a while ago, but there was this very strong, deep racism against Palestinians. We as Jews had the right to the land. It was our country, our being Israel. And it was mostly a fantasy Israel. It wasn't a real Israel. It was this kind of created Israel. And what my strong recollection really was that racism. It was that really harsh, unthinking, tribal nation that said Palestinians basically are trying to destroy us. Palestinians are the new Nazis. Back at the time, Yasser Arafat was the leader of the Palestinians. He was Hitler. All these kind of tropes that some listeners will be very familiar with, either from the past or frankly still today. How did that change? I think over the years I started feeling uncomfortable about that. I got to university in the 1990s, started reading more widely, started making friends who are more critical. I mean, I think we often forget, it shows my age here, that I grew up before the internet. So, of course, there are differing opinions around, but it was very, very different. It was more difficult to access that information. So, but I felt uncomfortable with what I was seeing in the Jewish community as this knee-jerk blind support for Israel. And I think by the time I started writing about this issue in the early 2000s. I visited Israel-Palestine for the first time in 2005. I've been going there every 3 or 4 years since, the West Bank, Gaza, and I was living in East Jerusalem between 2016 and 2020. I think if you asked me 20 years ago, I would have said two-state solution, Israel has a right to exist, definitely not an anti-Zionist. Fast forward to 2023, that's changed. I'm a proud anti-Zionist. I think Jews have the right to live safely, of course, but I think what Israel has become, and I thought this before I wrote this book, is really a morally collapsed society, that there has been the lessons that many Jews, both in Israel and the diaspora, have taken from the Holocaust is the wrong message. I'm not saying that what Israel's doing is like the Holocaust. I don't personally make that comparison. But there is a real tribal blindness. Yes, it's changing in parts of the Jewish community. Yes, there's growing conversation in Canada, in Australia, in the US, particularly in the UK, in Europe. There is a shift going on in the Jewish community. There's no doubt about that. But in the wider community, I think there's also public opinion is changing. We can discuss that later. So I guess my evolution really was, you could say that I was mugged by reality. I went there. I started reading more widely, and the impact, just briefly, has been that for a lot of my extended family, there's been a complete rupture. I don't have a relationship with them anymore, which doesn't particularly bother me because I don't particularly like them, for the record. But certainly when I was writing initially years ago, my parents lost most of their friends because of my views, because of my work, because of what I was saying and writing about Palestine. They mostly agreed with me, whereas years before, I spoke to my father about this recently, and he basically said he said that it was more his pro-Israel stance or his antagonism towards Palestinians was really based on ignorance. And I don't mean that to excuse it, but it was ignorance more than he'd spent decades studying the subject. And yes, the conclusion was that Palestinians were awful. No, it wasn't that. It was ignorance. And in the Jewish community, until relatively recently, it was a pretty small percentage of that population that did support Palestine, that even heard Palestinians. I mean, it seems crazy to say this now, but it's still pretty rare. I can't speak for Canada so much, although I think your community, the Jewish community, is not that dissimilar to the Jewish community here in Australia, that it's still absurdly rare to hear a Palestinian, to speak to a Palestinian. Many Jews who go to Israel do not speak to Palestinians. I mean, it seems crazy, but they'll go to, say, Tel Aviv and say, what's the problem? What's everyone? There's no occupation here. This is lovely. I'm going to the beach. It's beautiful. And yeah, you can go to Tel Aviv and have a lovely time. I've spent time there myself, but there is that willful blindness. So yeah, my evolution has been one of, I guess, community tribalism that morphed into an awakening, which is now translated into writing about it, speaking about it, living there, and being committed, I suppose, to not just trying to change the Jewish community, but trying to radically change the situation in Israel-Palestine itself.
Well, the outcome, I guess, of that process is this book that you just published, and congratulations.
Thank you.
I guess, to get into the content a little bit, you know, it's also in your introduction, you write, and it's sort of a bit of a thesis statement, that Palestine is Israel's workshop, where an occupied nation on its doorstep provides millions of subjugated people as a laboratory for the most precise and successful methods of domination. So that's quite a vivid, I don't even know if it's a metaphor, it's quite literal. Can you tell us, maybe start by telling us a little bit about how Israel's weapons industry uses Palestinians as testing subjects?
So Israel has run and controlled one of the longest occupations in modern times, and I'm talking mostly since 1967, although clearly there's been, these issues have existed since 1948. Where there has been pretty much a constant subjugated people, the Palestinians, obviously between 48 and 67, they're under some kind of military rule between 67 and today, 56 years and counting, there is also a form of military rule in the West Bank, Gaza. East Jerusalem is a bit different, but certainly Palestinians living there are not given equal rights, that's to be sure, and within Israel itself. And during those decades, what Israel has done is develop tools and technologies to find ways to repress and control what they view as an enemy population, Palestinians. And from their perspective, they would say it's been pretty successful. The world pretty much has not done anything about it. Israel has pretty much complete impunity, and we can discuss that. Yes, now and then the EU releases a terse statement, a press release expressing deep concern about expanding settlements. As we all know, the US even does that sometimes, but of course they're meaningless and the evidence is what's happening on the ground. And although this has been happening for decades, that Israel has used what's happening in Palestine as a laboratory, what I mean by that is that Israel was promoting its so-called skills in counterinsurgency. How do we control Palestinians? How do we crush their resistance? How do we essentially avoid any kind of serious uprising? This, of course, was before the First Intifada, which happened in the late 80s. And a lot of Latin and South American countries, dictatorships, often genocidal dictatorships, I'm talking about Colombia, South America, Guatemala, were asking Israel directly for help. Please come train our people. Please assist us in building death squads. I mean, the details are so extreme, yet true. And Israel back then, both the state itself and Israeli private companies were openly saying that we have the experience to assist you. And one of the, I guess, major alliances that I talk a lot about in the book, because I think it's still very relevant today, is Israel and apartheid South Africa. Now, apartheid ended in 1994. It's history. It's over, although South Africa today is still obviously a very broken country in a way, range of different ways. But at least apartheid's over officially, I would argue. There is still an economic apartheid there. But nonetheless, during that regime, Israel was one of South Africa's closest allies. It wasn't just about defense sharing, selling weapons, etc. It was an ideological alignment that both nations at the time were talking publicly and privately, that they were both fighting almost a war on barbarism. For the South Africans, they were fighting what they viewed as these horrible black South Africans who were trying to overtake their white nation. And Israeli Jews, the Israeli state, were fighting these horrible Palestinians who wanted to commit violence against them. So the narrative went. And both of them found a real alignment with each other. They felt that they were fighting a war for their survival. And you had South African politicians and military figures coming to Israel to watch what they were doing in the West Bank, and very importantly, vice versa. So you had Israeli military figures, prime ministers going to South Africa, talking about 70s, 80s, and looking to what South Africa was doing with their bantustans, which essentially were these black townships of sorts, which had nominal control, but essentially were run by the white government. And they admired that, and they wanted to create something similar in the West Bank. And they frankly have done that very successfully from Israel's perspective. Now, I mention all those examples, and there are so many others, because there were some savvier Israelis who realized after 67 that a lot of the world doesn't like what we're doing here. That there's obviously back then it was the Cold War, there was some who aligned with the Soviets, some who aligned with the US and Israel. But there were growing numbers of nations that openly said the occupation's wrong, we don't support it, it should end. And I would argue then, and definitely now, that by Israel selling all these tools and technologies, and what I mean by that briefly is everything from so-called intelligence gathering methods, harsh counterinsurgency techniques in the modern age, spyware, smart walls, facial recognition technology, biometric tools. That's almost like an insurance policy that if you have, as I found out in the book, over 130 countries, so the majority of countries in the world, that have bought some form of Israeli surveillance or defense technology in the last decades, how likely are those countries to be seriously opposing your rule? Now, yes, some of those nations are critical now and then, But ultimately, I would argue that actually what Israel has done is try to insulate itself from the potential of political headwinds that might come its way against the occupation. And the Palestine Laboratory really, in the end, is, yes, obviously it's partly a financial way for Israel to and Israeli companies to make money to sell these weapons. But I think it's also more than that. I see it as an insurance policy, which so far, I have to say, sadly, has been incredibly successful. And I think until people recognize that that is a key reason why Israel has such impunity, then I think little will change on the ground in Palestine itself.
It's interesting, too, that perhaps that, you know, by having this laboratory, this insurance policy, this that could be almost an incentive for maintaining the status quo as well, because you'd think that any kind of resolution, whether it was just annexation or two-state solution, it would sort of remove this no man's land type scenario where it kind of can get away with whatever they want as an occupying power. So
absolutely.
What do you think of that?
I think that's true. I mean, obviously there are key ideological reasons why Israel has no desire to resolve anything. I mean, a two-state solution, I would argue, was never going to happen anyway, but if it was, that ship sailed. Like, that ship has sailed a long time ago. I mean, it's a one-state solution now. It's an apartheid state, essentially. And I think what's often frustrated me in the last years, including in the writing of this book, has been the obsession with Netanyahu, this utter obsession in the West and within Israel itself. Now, this is not to defend him. I'm not a supporter of his, obviously. But it's kind of missing the point. Yes, he's the prime minister, has been for much of the last 10 years. He's a malignant figure. He's obviously empowered the far right in Israel at the moment. So all that's undeniably true. But the problem in Israel is not Netanyahu. Like, he's not the main problem here. He is a problem, but he's not the problem. In other words, if you remove him as prime minister, if he gets overthrown or replaced, which did happen, by the way, last year for roughly a year and a half, you think things are any different? In fact, that government under Lapid and Bennett was exactly the same. In fact, the rate last year of Palestinians being killed was the highest ever. This year may well overtake that. But the occupation continued, the settlements continued, the sale of weapons continued. Now, I'm not saying there's no difference. Obviously, Netanyahu has empowered a very, very far-right fascist government, highly disturbing. Those trends he's accelerated. The trajectory of Israel becoming a proudly Jewish supremacist nation, which it arguably has been for its whole existence, but it's much prouder of that now, is clear. But I absolutely agree with you that there is, apart from the fact that there's no incentive from a financial reason, there's no political pressure to do anything either. Like, where is that pressure coming from? As I said, the Arab countries now are mostly in bed with Israel or want Israeli technology and spyware. That's basically talking about Saudi, UAE, Bahrain, Egypt and Jordan are kind of peace, at peace with Israel nominally, but of course their people don't like Israel at all. The US bribes those countries to maintain some kind of peace relations with them. So the Arab countries are frankly, as I'm talking about leadership here, not the people, of course, they're almost a lost cause. The European Union, as I said, is Israel's biggest trading partner. Yes, they release occasionally stern statements and press releases, but they do absolutely nothing. The US is the major enabler of this. Yes, it was worse during the Trump era. I mean, Trump was really accelerating what was happening anyway. And yes, Biden has expressed his displeasure with Netanyahu in the last few months. Okay. And what changes? Nothing, right? And so where does that pressure come from? Now, I'm not saying civil society is not important, BDS. I'm not dismissing any of that at all. In fact, I support that. But as any listener will be aware, for any serious situation to change, there does need to be, at some point, pressure from countries economically and other ways, as with what happened with South Africa. South Africa didn't end apartheid because one day, you know, white South Africans woke up and they went, geez, it's like, this apartheid's pretty awful. We've got to change this. I mean, there were some white South Africans, who, some of whom I know, who were brave and fought that regime, both internally and externally, to be sure. And I'm not dismissing those brave white South Africans, but it was a minority, right? I mean, this battle was mostly fought by Black South Africans and the global community, who in the end turned against that country. Except, I might add, you know, the country that was with apartheid South Africa till right the end was Israel. And that's not accidental. As I said before, that's not just because they wanted South Africa to buy their weapons. It was ideological. So on the one hand, I think, and also just finally on this point, I mean, the Palestinians at the moment, I would argue, have never been politically more isolated. When I say that, what I mean is that the Palestinian Authority is run by a decrepit old man, Mahmoud Abbas, who has no real legitimacy. No one really likes him apart from probably his kids, and even they probably don't like him. He has nominal control over the West Bank, I guess, having spent time in the West Bank. He certainly runs a thuggish police force that essentially is maintaining the occupation for Israel. There's no legitimacy there whatsoever. Hamas, I would argue, also runs a pretty thuggish regime in Gaza, having spent time there. And I think there's a reason why in the last 5 or so years, so many young, particularly Palestinians, are expressing displeasure with both those entities, the PA and Hamas, and are looking for alternatives, whatever that may be. And unfortunately, at the moment, at least, of course, much of the world, or the Western world at least, still wants to prop up the Palestinian Authority because it's convenient, rather than having to deal with the issues if it collapses.
So you argue that Israel is not only marketing their weapons as battle-tested, but that it aims to export its model to the world. How is Israel's arms industry fueling the violent subjugation of people around the world? In other words, why should we, as people living in the West, in Canada, in Europe, care that our governments are complicit not only in Israeli occupation, but are buying these weapons and also using them back home?
We should care because these are often horrible, violent tools of subjugation. And as I said before, Israel has sold tools and technologies to over 130 countries. Israel is now the 10th biggest arms dealer in the world. The US remains top. About 40% of the world's weapons come from the US. And the US, as listeners will know, pretty much sells weapons to anybody. Israel is not much different. And of course, the US has also tested weapons in Iraq and Afghanistan. In fact, the current war in Ukraine is a massive testing ground for weapons. You have regular stories in the New York Times about this. So, but the difference, I suppose, with Palestine is that Israel's had, as you say, these subjugated people on its doorstep for more than half a century. And what I guess I try to explain in the book is this is how the occupation itself is both being exported. So the tools and technologies used to maintain that are used by a range of other countries who also want to subjugate their own people, minorities, journalists, dissidents, human rights workers. I mean, the most, I guess, infamous example in the last few years some listeners will be aware of is Pegasus, this Israeli spyware that can go on people's phones. Now, the spyware itself doesn't kill you. It's not a weapon of death per se, but that tool is something that is breaches privacy and is regularly used against dissidents and journalists and others, often in repressive regimes. But I think also something that Israel is exporting, and I talk about this in the book, is not just weapons. It's the concept of ethno-nationalism. It's this idea that Israel as a Jewish supremacist state is the ideal model. Let me explain briefly what that means. So not all nations that are buying Israeli technology and tools want to be an ethno-state. For example, Mexico has become in the last 12 or so years the biggest purchaser and user of Israeli spyware of all nations. They are obsessed with it. This is the previous right-wing governments, the current so-called left-wing government. They're obsessed with it. Now, Mexico doesn't want to become an ethno-state. Now, Mexico has lots of problems, but it's not determined to become, you know, a Christian ethno-state. But there are a lot of other nations in the last years, and South African apartheid would be a key one, but in the modern era, that look to Israel with admiration. And the countries that come to mind, and I talk about this in the book, Hungary under Orban, and obviously Hungary wants to be a Christian ethno-state, and he is certainly turning that country into one. But probably the most prominent and disturbing example, I would say, is India. India, in the last 10 years, obviously has been run by Prime Minister Modi. He's a Hindu fundamentalist. He is determined to build a Hindu ethno-state. There is deep and worsening violence against Muslims, who are 200 million people, 200 million Muslims in India. India is now the world's largest population country, recently overtook China. Its birth rate's much higher than China, which is why it's become number one. It's the world's largest self-described democracy, although I would question that, but that's how they describe themselves. And it's also become a nation that many Western nations are friends with now. US, Australia, Canada, and this is really one simple reason. It's not China. I mean, that's pretty much the long and the short of it. China is our new enemy. India is not. We're going to overlook all the gross human rights abuses. Now, why this is relevant to Israel is that I'm not arguing that India is doing all these horrible things because of Israel. They're not. But you have lots of leading key Indian officials openly admiring and talking about how they like what Israel is doing in the West Bank, and want to do something similar in Kashmir. Kashmir is a Muslim majority area in the north of that country. And what India has been doing in the last years is bringing in lots of Hindus to try to dilute that population. It's exactly the same methods that Israel's trying to do in the West Bank, to bring in lots of Jewish settlers. And I would argue, it's just as an aside, that I'm really thinking in the coming decades that I think you'll start seeing a lot of evangelical Christians moving into the West Bank. It hasn't really happened much yet. They're visiting, but they're not really living there. Because I think what Israel's finding, just as a brief aside, is they're going to run out of Jews who want to live there. Like, there actually aren't that many Jews in the diaspora who are moving to the West Bank. But I think you would find a lot of evangelicals who would love to go, which is a disturbing trend. Anyway, putting that aside. So India and Israel are increasingly close. They're a massively close arms trading nation between the two of them. But also, as I said, they inspire each other ideologically. So what I worry about is that Israel is not just inspiring people to want to buy invasive spyware, but also a nation that can export that ideology to other nations around the world. And finally, on this point, I think another worrying sign is, as we see in parts of the world, the global far right succeed or certainly take power, is that there's been this very weird alignment. I mean, weird on the one hand, but also disturbing, that if you go, which I do for work purposes, just to put that on the record, go to far right rallies to watch and in my case, report on them, you often find the Israeli flag. I'm talking about far-right neo-Nazi rallies, US, UK, Australia, I'm presuming Canada, but you can correct me if that's wrong. And you'll often find at these rallies people waving the Israeli flag. Now, on the face of it, people might say, hang on, these people are neo-Nazis. They don't like Jews. Like, what the hell is going on here? But actually, it makes perfect sense. Let me explain. It makes sense because they don't like Jews. That's for sure. But they really admire an ethno-state. They say openly, Israel is created what we want to create, but for Jews. They want to create a Christian ethno-state in Canada, in the US, in parts of Europe, in Australia. And, I mean, I have a quote in the book by Richard Spencer, who's a well-known sort of so-called alt-right, far-right leader, so to speak. And a few years ago, he called himself a white Zionist. And in some ways, I think that really sums it up. He doesn't like Jews, to be clear, at all. But he does love what Israel is doing. He loves the fact that Israel's got away with it. He loves the fact that Israel proudly, in his view, puts Jews above anybody else. And that's what he wants to create for Christians, in his case, America. So when Israel's exporting those ideas, they're not necessarily doing that for financial gain. I mean, although, as I said, in India's case, Israel's getting huge amounts of money from weapons, but they're exporting the possibility of what a nation can be And I would also say that they're exploiting the possibility. They're almost exploiting impunity to say, we've got away with it. We can do it. So can you. And that disturbs me in the 21st century, as I fear more and more nations and people look to Israel. Although, yes, there's a rising pro-Palestine sentiment, public opinion is shifting. All that is true. But there's also lots of other people who do look to Israel, sadly, as a model and an inspiration. And they're the people we should be worrying about.
Would you say that, you know, Israel exporting its tools of occupation is necessary for its survival?
It's a good question. I would say probably yes. And could Israel survive without exporting those weapons? I think it could survive possibly financially. It's not the sole way Israel makes money. It's obviously a growing way Israel makes money, to be sure. They're making money, as I said, through more traditional weapons, but also in the modern digital age, spyware and so-called smart walls and drones, etc. But as I said before, I do see it as more Israel's insurance policy, that when you have so many nations so reliant on you or your companies, that they're much less likely to come out against you. They may, as I said, release the occasional statement, or they may vote against you now and then in the UN. Although, to be clear, Israel often over the decades has made these kinds of friends to get votes in the UN. They literally say that. It's not really a secret. Most of this comes out years later through declassified documents that officials are trying to be friends with country X or country Y, often a dictatorship in Africa, South America, somewhere else, because they want the votes of the UN. Particularly since 67, where, as I said before, there is a sense that there's an awareness, at least in some so-called cleverer Israeli officials, that a lot of the world doesn't like what they're doing. They're not doing anything about it at all. And befriending nations and selling them weapons, as cynical and horrendous as that is, that's one way that you make friends. I would say it's a very transactional form of friendship. But it's a form of friendship, and it's also financially beneficial.
Definitely. So you mentioned that, you know, Israeli weapons aren't just limited to arms. Israel has some of the most advanced surveillance and spyware technologies. Maybe you could tell us a bit about Israeli spyware and how it affects both Palestinians and their allies around the world.
So the most infamous spyware has been Pegasus. As I was saying before, Pegasus is this spyware that can be put onto your phone without your knowledge, your cell phone, and essentially it takes control of it. It can get every piece of information on there, photos, videos, emails, anything. Even if you have so-called encrypted apps, WhatsApp, Signal, it makes no difference, meaning that any of those apps are not encrypted when your phone has been captured by Israeli spyware, essentially. And I go into detail in the book about this particular company, NSO Group, that's behind it, but I won't go into detail now. But suffice to say, they started about 15 years ago. Back in the day, they were trying to find ways to crack BlackBerries. Remember BlackBerries, those very archaic phones now, but that was all the rage back then. These days, of course, it's iPhones and other phones like that. And the biggest client, their first big client, was Mexico, as I said at the time. And Mexico was fighting a drug war. They wanted to get information about drug cartel bosses, etc., which then morphed then and now into going after dissidents, journalists, human rights workers, any kind of critic of the regime, right-wing regime or left-wing regime. And in the last decade and a half, NSO Group and other Israeli spyware companies have really become one of the, I would say, either top or second top companies in the world for this kind of technology, which is causing carnage because, and I interview a lot of people in the book who've been impacted by this, Indian lawyers, human rights workers in Togo, a human rights activist in Mexico whose husband was murdered by the Mexican state because he was reporting on drug cartels. And it's important to note that most of the people who are behind these companies are veterans of the IDF, Israeli Defense Force. There is almost like a funnel that there's a unit in the Israeli military called Unit 8200, which is the intelligence unit. And the people who work in that day to day, their job is to essentially surveil the entire Palestinian population, mostly the West Bank and Gaza. So any form of communication, literally any form of communication, so these days that would mostly be, you know, cell phones and email, can be listened to, watched, and controlled by Israel. And I'm not saying they listen to every single phone call, but they're able to control every single form of communication in and out of Palestine. And the people who work in that unit are often then encouraged when they leave to develop tools and technologies based on the experience that they have gained. So spyware is one area of that. And it's important to note that because so much of the media coverage in the last years, I discussed this in the book, has really infuriated me because it's been like, oh, there's this rogue Israeli spyware company selling this technology around the world. No, no, no. It's not a rogue company. It's an arm of the state. This is how it works. So in the last 10 years, Netanyahu and the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence unit, goes around the world and is holding out tools like Pegasus as a diplomatic carrot. They will say, we would like to be friends with you. I'm talking about nations like Saudi Arabia, UAE, Rwanda, all repressive states. We'd like to be friends with you. And if you become friends with us, again, going back to this question of transactional friendship, we will sell you this amazing spyware. You want to go after your dissidents and activists and human rights workers? Let us assist you, please. And it's been pretty effective from Israel's perspective. They have made all these wonderful new friends. Now, how long-term these friends are, I guess we can discuss. But and there have been examples in the last years of Israel surveilling Palestinians in Palestine with this technology. About a year or two ago, there was the leading Palestinian human rights organizations, Al-Haq and others, had their leaders of their organizations, it was discovered that their phones had been hacked by Pegasus, an NSO group. Some Israeli Jewish critics have also had their phones surveilled. The numbers of countries that have had the presence of Pegasus, no one even knows the exact number. We think it's in the high dozens. I'm going to say 80. That's a rough guess because no one actually knows. I mean, a company would know, but roughly 80. You can't get much information out of them, but it's a lot. Democracies and dictatorships. And, you know, Israeli spyware has become so ubiquitous that it's not just Pegasus. There's a range of other companies. In the last years, as Pegasus started getting a lot of bad press, there was lots of journalistic investigations into, I'm sure listeners will remember, how these tools have ended up on lots of dissidents' phones around the world. A lot of Israeli alternatives have sprung up, almost so-called clean skins, doing exactly the same thing, but don't have the taint of NSO Group's reputation. So in some ways now, in the digital era of the 21st century, Israel has become known, or I would say infamous, for this unbelievably sophisticated spyware, companies that routinely are only private in name. They're arms of the Israeli state. And the reason that happens is, as I said, because they have had close relations in this intelligence unit, they then want to maintain that once they've left the army or left the military officially, because it benefits them financially by almost being used by the state to promote their products, because that's literally how it has worked. Netanyahu has gone to Hungary and India and Rwanda and Saudi Arabia, and as I show in the book, within 6 or 12 months of those visits, in every single case, Pegasus started being used in those nations. That's not accidental. It's deliberate. And I think that, again, shows that how the laboratory works here, that there is that these weapons, Pegasus itself wasn't necessarily solely tested on Palestinians, but the people behind it got their experience surveilling Palestinians. I mean, they came from these intelligence units in the IDF. So again, it's sort of a modern way of monetizing the occupation. There's finally, apart from spyware, of course, there's also been other forms of surveillance. So facial recognition is increasingly big in Palestine against Palestinians, biometric data gathering, so-called smart walls, a range of other tools. And again, they're something which Israel is increasingly exporting to nations that are, and I say this in the book, nations that are increasingly looking not just to control populations, but I would say as years go on and we're likely to find more and more nations wanting to, I fear, fight back, say, climate refugees, which is going to be an increasing issue in parts of Asia and the rest of the world. A lot of nations are turning to Israeli technology, which how successful that is long term is hard to say, but certainly in the short to medium term, I think it will be, because there are ways to either deter people, surveil people, keep them back from borders, monitor them at borders, build so-called smart walls, higher walls. Now, whether you're going to stop millions and millions of climate refugees in the long run is an open question. I'm not convinced that you can, unless, of course, you go the dystopian vision of the future, which is the only way to do that is mass violence. Now, I don't really go into detail about that in the book, but you know, in my darker moments, I do fear that is where some countries will go to deter people. I mean, it's not hard to imagine. In fact, Trump started doing this, and he talked about it openly on the US-Mexico border. Why couldn't the US start literally shooting at people trying to enter the border? Why couldn't they do that? They could. Why couldn't they use drones to drone people? Why couldn't you use armed drones in the Mediterranean to shoot people out of the water? Why not? It's dystopian and horrible thought. But I don't think, frankly, we're that far away from that possibility, and that's a pretty scary thought.
Yeah, and I think there's so much that I want to kind of jump in on, but I think one Canadian connection, too, that's worth just throwing out there, because we often forget about it when we're talking about Israeli, these spyware companies and their role in this sort of diplomacy. There's actually a significant Canadian connections to that as well. There's this one Toronto-based company that finances Israeli spyware. Our former Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, is significantly involved in that and trying to broker deals to sell that spyware to the UAE. That same company hired to head their subsidiary to the UAE, they hired the former Canadian representative in Ramallah. So it's like there's this very strange thing happening where Canadians are getting in on this whole game and sort of advancing maybe Canada's foreign policy through the sale of Israeli spyware to repressive dictatorships around the world. And it's just such a, it's not just Israelis, I guess, who are getting in on the Definitely. Action with this technology, which is really disturbing. I do want to talk a little bit about Elbit Systems as well, because that's something that we focused on here. Yeah. We've had a campaign for a few years. Canada has purchased a drone a couple of years ago from Elbit Systems. This is, we've had a few podcast episodes about this, but this is one of Israel's largest weapons companies. It produces a ton of all sorts of things that are used by the Israeli army, but including drones that are used to kill civilians in Gaza. We've also seen in the UK a lot of really interesting activism, direct action, actually targeting directly the weapons factories, the manufacturers, and actually having these protests that actually shut down their operations, and in some cases actually seem to have success in leading the company to decide to shut down that specific factory. I guess, are you following that at all? What impact do you think that kind of action has on the ability, not just Elbit, but Is that a viable strategy for combating this?
I think it's one strategy, and I am following, and I talk a bit about that in the book, particularly in relation to the UK. You're talking about Palestine Action, which founded a number of years ago, and as you said, their strategy seems to be directly targeting Elbit system factories across the UK a number have shut down. And there have been a lot of interesting examples of these individuals often are arrested, they're charged with trespass, they go before a judge, and in I think pretty much every case that I can recall, the judge lets them off as legitimate protest. It's kind of quite remarkable, actually. Now, at some point, mirroring what we're seeing increasingly as heavy state repression against climate activists in much of the Western world, US, UK, here in Australia. I don't know so much about Canada, but I'm guessing that's going to be coming there soon if it hasn't. The climate activists who, you know, shutting down a road for a protest or, you know, something like that to protest the climate crisis, that often these people are either charged, fined, or put in prison, which to me is insane, but that seems to be the heavy hand of the state against that. So I fear that that will start happening in the UK too against these kind of activists. But is it a viable? It is one. I think direct action is definitely a key one, because also it's about making people aware through those actions, which I guess through media, social media, what the hell these companies are doing. What are they doing? Why are they based in the UK? What weapons are they producing? What is Elbit? Who is Elbit? Why are they, as you say, operating in Palestine but around the world? And I talk a lot about Elbit in there in the book, because they are Israel's biggest defense company. They're operated in God knows how many countries around the world. They have sold, I didn't know about the drone that Canada has. They've also working with the European Union, that the EU uses Israeli drones over the Mediterranean, their eye in the sky, so to speak, to watch refugees, most of whom are coming by boat from Africa or Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria. And the EU has made the decision in the last years to let people drown. I mean, it's a pretty clear, they don't say that if you ask them, of course, but that's the practical reality. If you don't rescue people at sea on rickety boats, they're going to die. And that's what the EU is doing, has been doing now for a number of years. So Israel and Israeli drones play a part in that. These drones are unarmed, but they are an eye in the sky. So they're providing the vision to European officials who can see if a boat's in trouble. And if those boats are regularly either left to disintegrate and, you know, people are dying, or that sometimes the EU is handing over refugees to the Libyan Coast Guard, who then take these people back to Libya. And Libya essentially is a failed state. It's, you know, there are slave auctions. Libya is, what's happening there is horrible, but the EU is helping them to do that. They're funding them. And I mention that because, again, you have an Israeli involvement. I'm not saying Israel is involved in Libya, but, you know, in the over the Mediterranean, you have massive surveillance towers along the US-Mexico border by Elbit. And Elbit sold that and promoted it because it had been tested in Palestine across the West Bank and across the Israel-Gaza border, so to speak. So I definitely think that if anything can be done to raise awareness of what Elbit is doing, who they are. And also, I think it's interesting in the UK, I think to some extent there's a vulnerability there, that Elbit's not about to shut down tomorrow, but they did shut down quite a few factories. They actually don't want bad press. They're very powerful. They've got friends at the highest levels of government, to be sure. And I'm sure it's the same in Canada under Trudeau. But there is, to me, a real sense of they actually don't want that much attention. Not many companies do. Some companies will say any publicity is good publicity. I'm not really sure that's true in the case of Elbit. I mean, I don't know if it's stopping them getting business now, but I do think direct action and raising awareness of what companies like that are doing, almost to name and shame, embarrass them, shame them, advocate boycotting them, putting pressure on governments to not contract them, is a definitely viable and important tool. It's a legitimate, non-violent civil society action, which frankly has been used against lots of other companies over the years. And it's legitimate. So I do support it. And I'm really encouraged by what's happening in both your country and in the UK particularly, at a time where Israel, I think, tries to launder its image. And if anything can be done to challenge that, then bring it on.
Yeah, I think one complication in Canada when it comes to direct action of the type that Palestine Action does is that we don't have identifiable factories producing Israeli weapons for Elbit. We have a very obscure system where many companies are producing components that are sold as military tech, that may be incorporated into larger military systems. But it's components, and it's basically, you can't find out, like there's no public record of who is producing what and where they're selling it. So it's, unless a company puts out a press release saying we are producing this for Elbit Systems, there's no way to know about it. But I did also want to just note too that, yeah, when we're talking about the use of these things, like this Elbit drone that Canada purchased, supposedly it's supposed to be for environmental monitoring in the Arctic, which itself is kind of a colonial sort of endeavor. But I think a lot of the concern is that it'll be used against Indigenous land defenders, against Indigenous protests, against other forms of protest, using the lessons that Elbit, you know, had developed in the occupied Palestinian territories in Gaza, applying that to, you know, Canadian approaches here against its own population, even if it's not in a direct military armed way, there's still a repressive element that is being learned there that is concerning for sure.
I agree with that. And just briefly on that point, some listeners will remember the Standing Rock protests in the US a few years ago. Now, as far as I know, there was no Israeli involvement there, so I'm not saying there was. However, what you saw there was a really disturbing model of exactly what you're talking about, of mass surveillance by the state and the company against both Indigenous and non-Indigenous protesters. These protests went on and on and on, obviously for a long time. People can Google that if they don't remember it. And again, I'm not saying Israeli technology was involved in that, but the model is there, that as there is going to be growing both Indigenous and non-Indigenous protests against, say, fossil fuel outlets or whatever the issue may be, you will find a growing use of surveillance, everything from drones to spyware. I mean, it is getting increasingly sophisticated how these kinds of tools and technologies are used against protesters. So I think your concern about what might happen in Canada is a legitimate one. It could well happen. I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't have Elbit drones flying over a protest. They might not be armed, but it's very conceivable, or other companies for that matter. And then, yeah, so I think being aware of that and talking about that as we see surveillance increasing in our societies is definitely important.
Reem, do you have any final questions that you'd like to ask? You want to jump in on?
Yeah, I guess how can people support you, buy your book? Of course, we'll have the link to your book on Verso in the description. And maybe if you want to tell us any other projects that you're working on.
Yeah, thank you. Well, yeah, people can buy the book. They should obviously buy multiple copies because, you know, Christmas is coming and family and friends would love this. So, yes, that would be lovely. You can find all details about my work at just my website. It's just my name, anthonylowenstein.com. Maybe you guys can put that in the notes as well. Look, I work on lots of different issues. I mean, I've written over the years lots of books about other subjects, the war on drugs, disaster capitalism. I mean, this in some ways, although I don't say this in the book itself, the new one, this is a form of disaster capitalism. It's people making money from misery. In this case, it's mostly Israeli companies and the Israeli state. And I am trying to get a film version up of this book, film or TV version, which is a work in progress, easier said than done, but hold that thought, watch this space, hopefully in the next year or so, and various other projects I'm working on. But people can find all that just at my website, really. And, yeah, people can Google my name and lots of stuff comes up. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Anthony, for joining us today. This was a great conversation.
Thank you.
Really interesting. And yeah, I definitely hope that our listeners will check out the book. And yeah, you know, when your movie comes out, your next project comes out, we'll make sure to have you on the podcast as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Thanks. Thank you.
If you're a listener and you enjoyed our podcast today, please subscribe to our channel. We're on all the major audio podcast platforms. If you can, please leave a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps people find our program and learn about the issues. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. If you have any questions or comments or suggestions about our podcast or our topics, please feel free to email us at info@cjpme.org. That's it for now, but thanks for listening and see you all again soon.